Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. Religious and community leaders condemn the killing of civilians in Pajok town.
Cardinal role of the government is to protect. One cardinal role is to protect the civilian. But we have already realized that principle of protecting the civilian is already not there. It's already not there. People have gone away. People have died.
And another deadly fighting broke out between government troops and rebels in Mapel, Payam.
The government soldiers turn on civilians. What they say that yes, all people from that area are rebel supporters. Yet some of the people who even had been killed were some youth who has even joined hands together with some government to fight those rebels.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Religious and community leaders in Imatong State are accusing government forces of slaughtering more than 130 civilians, including women and children. The leaders say the soldiers clashed with an armed group in an area near Pajok Payam on Monday. Some villagers fled in fear after soldiers told them not to leave. Witnesses say those who stayed behind were arrested, tied, and shot to death. Thousands of villagers fled to northern Uganda, as we hear from Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
Bishop Bernard Oringer of the Episcopal Church in Torit confirms the death toll from yesterday's fighting in Pajok area in Motong State has risen to at least 135 people. Bishop Oringer says local sources in Pajok told him that a majority of those killed were deliberately targeted by the SPLA soldiers.
The figure from the church representatives on the ground was that so far 135 died, which includes those who must have died in the crossfire. Some of them must have been slaughtered.
The exasperated bishop says several women and children drowned while trying to cross the Pagay River during the violence.
What about the women and the children? This is the question we are asking ourselves, because women were also killed and those arrested, I'm doubting whether they were found with guns in their hands.
Sebit Omar is among those who fled the violence. He says when the army started shooting, he jumped onto his motorbike and crossed the bridge into the bush.
People came to the residential area and started shooting people. That's why many people ran away, looting, breaking doors, taking all, even the farm chicken, even the farm, you have grinding mill, you just shoot that grinding mill. Destruction. They didn't come for protection. They're supposed to protect us. This thing started at 8 a.m. in the morning. I was there in the center. I was to my house. And you hear the guns inside the residential area shooting. And the rebels are not there. They know where the camp of the rebel is there. They know it very well. They know.
Imatong State Governor Tobiolo Alberio Oromo said he will travel to Pajok to establish facts about what happened there. SPLA Deputy Spokesman Colonel Santo Dominic says he is skeptical about the number of casualties reported by eyewitnesses.
I did not heard of 100 people being killed, you know, by the SPLA. It is alarming. And I think should this one be true, then actually the chief of general staff of the SPLA could have even gone to the area and we could have all moved there. Because I talked to Benson Onek, you know, the commission of IAD, there is nothing like that.
Dominic insists the casualty figures have been exaggerated by what he calls negative elements who want to tarnish the image of the SPLA.
It doesn't make sense, because if the SPLA could actually chase either the rebels or the bandits, and then it comes back and fight, you know, the civil population who have got no guns in their arms, it doesn't make sense for me. Because nowadays, the rebels and the sympathizers of the rebellion are actually waging a very serious manufactured negative media campaign against the SPLA.
Oketa Joseph is among the villagers who fled Monday's violence. He's speaking by phone from Ngomoromo along the South Sudan-Uganda border. He says UNHCR, the Lutheran World Federation, and MSF or the French medical group Doctors Without Borders are also providing emergency assistance to the most vulnerable people.
The problem which is affecting us here is the water, problem of water. And food also is not yet there. They started giving only biscuit to the young one and the older people and those who are sick.
Civil society activists and church leaders in the Imotong state capital, Turit, issued a statement today condemning the violence, adding that it undermines the national dialogue President Salva Kiir announced late last year. Reverend Peter Sandara is the interchurch committee chairman in Imotong state. He says the killings in Pajok completely undermines efforts to restore peace across the country.
The army is supposed to be establishing this because what we expect always, the army is supposed to protect the people. And the army is not a separate entity.
Charles Okulo is the chairperson of the civil society network in Imotong State. He too condemned the killing of civilians in Pajok.
The act is so unfortunate. I call this act is very unfortunate. It has happened. The role of the government, the cardinal role of the government is to protect. One cardinal role is to protect the civilian. But we have already realized that principle of protecting the civilian is already not there. It's already not there. People have gone away. People have died.
Bishop Oringa says locals have told him 6,000 to 7,000 fleeing villagers have arrived in the Ugandan border town of Ngomoromo since Monday's attack. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Turit.
From Turit, we'll move to Mapel, where community leaders in Kwarjina County in Wau State say at least 7 people, including civilians, were killed and 3 others wounded yesterday during fighting between government forces and rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar. Kwarjina County Commissioner says rebel forces attacked a military post in Mapel, forcing government troops to respond. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
County Commissioner Barjuk Uchu says in Arabic that government and opposition forces clashed Tuesday evening after rebel forces loyal to Machar attacked a government military base.
Yesterday at around 4:30 p.m., rebel forces attacked the Mapel military base and the government forces were able to exchange fire with them and the rebels ran away. The casualties of the incident include 2 brothers and 1 disabled person was also killed.
Uchu says a rebel brigadier general was also killed during the fighting. Uchu says thousands of civilians fled into the bush during the fighting. He is calling on aid agencies to visit the area and provide assistance to the needy.
Civilians are in the bush and up to now they are still there. I have instructed local administrative officers to go and tell them to come back. Some of them are trying to come back, but they are still afraid.
A community activist from the area who does not want to be identified by name for fear of reprisal says although the rebels started the fighting, most of the dead were killed by the government soldiers. Speaking by phone from Wau, the anonymous source says eyewitness told him government forces in the area accused members of the local community in Mapel of being rebel supporters.
I hear that the rebels were fighting with the government. And finally, the government soldiers turn on civilians. What they say that yes, all people from that area are rebel supporters. Yet some of the people who even had been killed were some youth who has even joined hands together with some government to fight those rebels. And so once they were returning back from fighting, they turned guns against them.
The source says Mapel is now a ghost town.
There are no civilians in Mapel because all the civilians ran out. People now are in the forest. They are not even in the town.
South Sudan's Army Deputy Military Spokesperson Santo Domich confirms that the government forces fought with rebel at market located within the residential area in Mapel, but says rebel forces came to the market with an intention of looting, but government forces responded in time.
The intervention of the SPLA was quick. In the process, they left four of the members on the ground dead, including a brigadier general.
The other three soldiers with the AK-47 were taken from them.
SPLA IO military spokesperson William Gadget Deng confirms his group battled government forces in Mapel, but he blames government forces for starting the clashes. Gadget did not disclose how many rebel fighters died during the fighting, saying he has yet to receive final casualty figures from the rebel military commander in Mapel. Domich says the government side has instructed the SPLA's 5th Division commander in Wau to deploy more troops along Wau-Tonch Road so that traders and other civilians can travel safely in the area. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Africa's biggest refugee crisis is bigger by the day, is getting bigger by the day. Thousands of South Sudanese continue to cross into Uganda as violence and hunger rage at home. More than 800,000 South Sudanese have made their way to Uganda. Many are coming from Yei in central Equatoria, one of the areas hardest hit by the ongoing conflict. VOA's Jill Craig reports from the border in northern Uganda.
The buses keep rolling in, bringing more South Sudanese from border points in northern Uganda to refugee settlements, their new homes for the foreseeable future. In Busia, only a short footbridge separates South Sudan from Uganda. The newcomers often arrive malnourished, thirsty, and exhausted. 30-year-old Abui John Tadeo was a mathematics teacher before he fled on foot with his wife and three children. He arrived at the border 2 hours ago and is waiting for a bus to take him and his family to the Kaluba collection point.
I need to leave here because there's a lot of shooting, looting. So we are tired, that's why we need to leave here, so that we rest a little bit.
Like Tadeo, many of these new arrivals are from Yei and other places in the Equatoria region, which has experienced intense fighting. More than 816,000 South Sudanese refugees have come to Uganda fleeing violence. Susan Gune also comes from Yei, and she and her family now stay in the Mvepi refugee settlement. She says they came to Uganda because life is hard and risky, and they will not go back because people are killing us, chasing us to the bush, burning us inside our houses. She says in Uganda they have a secure life. Esther Akujo is a 24-year-old refugee who brought her three children to Uganda alone. Her husband was arrested before they left. She says there is no more food, people are starving, and there is no medical access. There are no roads for the food to get into town. She says when people bring food from rural areas, armed men collect it and the people in town suffer. While life at home was difficult, Rose Nyanga says so was the journey to Uganda. She says for 14 days they walked day and night, surviving on wild fruits and stagnant water. Fabi and Richard Wani trekked for 10 days with his wife, children, and a group of orphans from Yei, but he says he still has hope for his country.
I'm looking for the future of the country, and for us to achieve the peace, we need to be godly fearing people, and the leaders should also accept their mistakes and they see the suffering of their own citizens so that the future of the country will be very bright.
Refugees in the Ugandan settlements are given a 50-meter by 50-meter plot of land to be used for shelter and cultivation, in addition to food, water, non-food items, health services, and children's education. Jill Craig, VOA News, in northern Uganda.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, women take part in the search for peace. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
should primary school be free?
Yes, because it's the foundation of education, so every foundation should be free, given to everybody, should be free.
Yes. Totally free. This is because most, especially the, is it low class in Kenya, anywhere in Africa, you find that they have very many kids and they have no the capital to take them to school. And
I strongly condemn the freeness of primary schools. Why? Because mostly I can say free things are never better. They will never push you.
I think it should be free because here in Malawi, most of the families are poor.
Don't think so, because in primary is the foundation of education. And we know anything free is expensive at the end of it all.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese women activists say women are playing a bigger role in peace building since the transitional government of national unity was formed in 2015. In a forum organized by the Solidarity for Women's Rights Association in Juba, women said while some parts of the AGAS deal have been implemented, the government must do more to restore peace in the country, and women should play a greater role in politics. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
More than 30 women representing 10 women organizations talk about challenges and opportunities women have encountered since the transitional government of national unity was formed about a year ago. Commissioner Betty Oboy Itono of the South Sudan Peace Commission says ongoing violence in parts of the country has hindered women from promoting reconciliation at the grassroots level and has hurt women in particular.
The war has really made an obstacle for them to reach where they could possibly have reached. Because there are certain areas that were inaccessible, they cannot reach there, but there are others, of course, that they went to talk about peace. And secondly, the economic crisis is so biting. The women are very desperate. They have families to take care of. The economic situation does not allow these women really to be so effective because they really have to take charge of their own families.
Itono says many women were traumatized after renewed fighting broke out in Juba last July when they experienced unspeakable crimes.
Some of the women also have suffered things like rape, seeing their family members killed in front of them. That one has really raise the level of trauma in the country for women because the coping mechanism is really a nil. It's not anywhere near.
Itono says women in particular want to see South Sudan's leaders implement Chapter 5 of the peace deal, which provides for the formation of a hybrid court to try perpetrators of abuses, including rape, killing, and forced displacement. Sunday Moga, who represents the local NGO Women Grassroots Network, says even after the formation of the transitional government of national unity, many women have been displaced or have sought refuge in neighboring countries due to ongoing fighting and hunger. Speaking in Arabic, Moga wonders how displaced women will get a chance to take part in the peace process.
Nas biga bezgi focus fok fok. Nas bezgi door fok fok.
Peace and reconciliation programs are now focusing only on the national level, and the women of the grassroots are unforgotten, while they deserve to be part of the process. How is it going to work? We should develop a mechanism through which we can build a good network with them. No one should always speak on behalf of the others, every time.
Sarah Apeja, who represented the National Women Empowerment and Rehabilitation Organization at the forum, says the economic crisis in the country has reduced women's ability to take part in peace-building activities because women are focused on feeding their children and staying alive.
When these women and the grassroots are economically empowered, they will go and vote. They will speak out. When a man tries to shut you down, you have your food. How will he punish you? Some men punish us by not giving us money for food because we are here, goalkeepers, waiting. But if we are producing, when he tries to shut you down, but you are economically empowered, you are able to move on, then you will have to begin working like partners, not again the other one to be on the upper hand.
Apeja says women can become producers again in South Sudan if the men lay down their guns and stop abusing women. Itono says despite several challenges women face, there are still ways women can help achieve peace in South Sudan. She says the more than 10 women groups who gathered in Juba this week are advocating for peace and reconciliation across the country. A message, she says, can reach a wider population if people are willing to listen. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
From Juba, we move back to Uganda, where activists from Sudan's Nuba Mountains, based in Kampala, say the conflict in South Sudan has made life difficult for their people who are facing a looming humanitarian disaster. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
After South Sudan became a country in 2011 and fighting later broke out in 2013, Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile residents felt they were left without a strong ally. In 2012, South Sudan and Sudan signed a number of agreements, including one that called for the expulsion of rebels fighting in each other's countries. Sausan Mohammed, an activist from the Nuba Mountains who joined the SPLM-SPLA in 1998, says her people initially hailed the independence of South Sudan.
So when the war broke in South Sudan, it really affected people because the movement, we used to take goods, we used to take food, we used to come for the for educations and also for peace, because most people came to South Sudan to look for jobs to support their family there. So it's really a problem to Nuba Mountains.
Nuba Mountains journalist and activist Kadia Aburida Shimela says the Nuba people remained loyal to Garang.
During the very famous crisis of SPLM-SPLA 1991, the Nuba people stands beside Dr. John Garang de Mabior those days, and they were like a main player.
Mayla says the people of the Nuba Mountains expected South Sudan to stand with them in their hour of need, but South Sudan was under enormous pressure to distance itself from the rebels in the north. Speaking in Arabic, Nuba Mountains political activist Magdi Musa Kodi says it's understandable why South Sudan moved away from the SPLM north.
What happened was that South Sudan as a country disengaged itself from the SPLA North as a revolutionary organization, so it could.
Sausan Mohammed, a physician and former Khartoum University lecturer, says the change in strategies also affected delivery of humanitarian aid and other forms of support to the people of the Nuba Mountains.
People are dying from starvation, from famine. There is a very huge displacement in the area. There is no access to basic human beings' needs.
Kodi says the government in Khartoum continues to bomb civilian hideouts in the mountains.
I strongly appeal to regional and international civil society organizations to exert pressure on the regime to immediately end its aerial bombardment of civilians' areas.
In recent weeks, the SPLM North has been embroiled in internal political strife. Nuba members tried to unseat the organization's Secretary General Yasser Arman from office. Kodi insists the main cause of the bickering is over the failure of the current leadership to convene a party convention to draft and pass a new constitution and to elect new members.
Unfortunately, the caretaker leadership failed to take the step and initiative to call a convention to address these concerns. Consequently, the crisis deepened.
Mohammed, Kodi, and Shimela all support efforts to revamp the SPLM North leadership and redefine the group's objectives ahead of upcoming negotiations with the Sudanese government. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Kampala.
And here in Washington, U.S. members of Congress asked panelists at a hearing on sanctions against Sudan yesterday to measure the country's progress on human rights since former U.S. President Barack Obama temporarily lifted sanctions in January. SIN Bio reports the panelists have different views on whether lifting sanctions on Sudan was the right thing to do.
While one panelist at yesterday's congressional hearing said the easing of sanctions undermines U.S. foreign policy objectives, another said the sanctions have so far been ineffective in pressuring the Sudanese government to respect the human rights of its citizens. Omar Ismail, a senior advisor with the Enough Project, says President Barack Obama's move to ease sanctions in January was a deeply flawed policy decision in both design and execution.
It undermines U.S. foreign policy objectives. It gives away U.S. leverage
for nothing beyond a potential short-term counterterrorism gain. It does nothing to address the structural issues in Sudan. The human rights protections and democracy demands of the Sudanese people were not even part of the plan. War, repression, human rights violations, and dictatorship have continued in the months since the Sudanese government's supposed positive actions that justify the sanctions easing first began.
Ken Isaacs, Vice President of Programs and Government Relations for Samaritan's Purse, a non-denominational evangelical Christian international relief organization, says sanctions in Sudan have failed to yield their intended result and says it's time the U.S. consider lifting broad trade sanctions.
We cannot move forward with lifting sanctions, however, unless we are willing to candidly look at past actions and current challenges. To help our Sudanese friends, we need a brief, candid review of how we got to where we are now.
Isaac says trade sanctions hurt the most vulnerable people by restricting development in medical care, transportation, and education, and at the same time are ineffective in convincing governments to change their behavior.
If Congress and the new administration desire an end to Sudan's destabilizing pattern of conflict and displacement, U.S. sanctions going forward should focus on strategies that provides unimpeded humanitarian access to all areas in and out of their control, delivers an end of hostilities along with peace negotiations in Darfur and the two areas by allowing the simultaneous participation of all parties.
Isaac says it should also include a political process whereby the root causes of conflict can be addressed. President Obama's executive order makes reference to counterterrorism priorities, but does not provide guidance on how to measure progress on human rights, according to Jahan Henry, who is a senior researcher for the Human Rights Watch. Henry says it's important for the United States to include a human rights benchmark and to demand the country respect the basic human rights of its people.
Across the country, the Sudanese government continues to use violence and repression to silence dissenters and critics. Its security forces use lethal force to disperse protests, and in 2013 left more than 170 people killed on the streets of Khartoum, Wad Medani, and other towns, most of them shot point blank in broad daylight, and no justice has been brought for these killings.
Henry adds that Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Service, or NISS, has wide-ranging powers to arrest and detain citizens, which often leads to citizen abuse. She says it has been documented that the NISS practices torture and continues to target journalists and activists, as well as others perceived as critics of the government. Henry says the Trump administration has a chance to reassert the importance of human rights in Sudan and should use that opportunity. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
That report by Ayan Bior brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with a song from Darfur by Abdelmajid Kureiba. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for inviting us into your homes and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Beri biyedi dararu, iyaru be dararu, abdaru be dararu. Shankola ashliga harad la daigo
البيل يا